right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a really, really interesting program for you today. And it's one that I'm really looking forward to doing because it's concentrating on everything that I've been thinking a lot about over the last few months and maybe even the last couple of years. And that is one of the most pressing things that's been on my mind is the future of the planet and what the hell this system, this capitalist system is doing to the Earth and everyone and every creature in it, every plant in it, every organism in it, and where it's headed and what's happening with that. So at the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I did with Alex Rogers, Professor Alex Rogers. Oh, it's a little bit more than a year ago, but I think it's really worth running again. Alex is from Oxford University, and he's the co-founder and scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean. And Alex spoke with us about the horrific state of affairs with regard to the oceans on this planet. And that is very, very much tied into what our opening segment is about. At the beginning of the show, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Orpheus Reed. Orpheus is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he writes on environmental issues and the climate. And he recently had an article called The Sixth Extinction and the Future of Life on Planet Earth. And how the hell could you not want to hear about and dig into something that has that title? And Orpheus is here to talk with us about this. Orpheus, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. Really glad to be here and be able to talk to people about this important topic today.
Great. Well, let's jump into it, man. What are you talking about here, The Sixth Extinction? It's not just a scary movie title. What are you talking about?
Right. So what we're talking about is that there has been five previous mass extinctions in the history of the planet. These past mass extinctions have happened over long, long periods of geological time, over the 4.6 billion years of our planet. And they've been mainly caused in the past by natural causes. Now we're entering into a period of mass extinction of species that is caused by humans. And it's not something that's just caused by human nature or just human activity in the abstract. But one of the things this article is getting into, you know, we'll talk a lot more about how do we know this is a sixth extinction and what is a mass extinction. You know, we're talking about the elimination of large numbers of species way beyond what is normal, kind of in normal times, whatever those are, but, you know, way beyond the normal extinction rate that happens. There's an extinction of species that's happening way more often, way more commonly, and it's also spread among not just one geographical area, I should say, but it's spread all over the planet.
All right, and that's exactly, actually, I'm going to get into that in a little bit, but I wanted to follow this out a little bit more because one of the things that you say in this article, and it's something that I think, well, a lot of people will talk about, you know, we're having global warming and it's getting hotter out, and they look at that as they're judging things from the basis of what they can immediately see. But you say that many scientists, actually, this is not a situation where many scientists are sitting around saying, okay, just, God, I'm sweating a lot more. It just seems the summers are hotter. But they actually view this as a deep crisis situation, this current rate of extinctions. What do they mean by that? And why is it so different than what's been going on since the history of the planet?
There's a lot of different aspects to that, but the reason it's different than what's been happening in the past is, as I say, there have been mass extinctions that happen very rarely. You know, the last one, for instance, was caused by an asteroid strike 65 million years ago. And this kind of event is something that wipes out huge percentages of species on the Earth. So it wiped out the dinosaurs, last mass extinction event. So we're talking about a huge, catastrophic kind of change in a relatively short period of time, geologically speaking. I'm talking about thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years. This one's happening quicker than a lot of those previous mass extinctions. And the stakes are really the whole biodiversity of the planet. The stakes are whether all these beautiful and wonderful species that we have will continue to exist. And there many are already threatened and some have already gone out of existence. And also, this has a huge ramification for humanity on this planet. There's many ways in which kind of functioning ecosystems, rich, diverse ecosystems, impact the way humanity can live. And in fact, ecosystems are necessary for humanity to survive on this planet. There's a thing that scientists call ecosystem services provided by nature that humanity actually needs in order to survive. So many species provide things like food, clean water, nutrient cycling, things like crop pollination, control of climate and disease, as well as like our appreciation of them. All these things are ecosystem services, as they're called, that nature provides to humanity. So they're things that really impinge on the ability for humans to continue to survive. So So what we're talking about when we're talking about a mass extinction is things that are a threat, one, to the diversity and to the existence of species, but we're also talking about human survival here being at stake. And in fact, one of the things I brought up and kind of helped really push forward the idea of the article was a new study that appeared in Science Advances magazine recently that was done by some biologists. It was called Accelerated Modern Human-Induced Species Losses Entering the Sixth Mass Extinction. People can find that on the internet. They just look up Science Advances. And one of the points that one of the lead authors of this study made is that, and I'm going to quote him here, he said, if it's allowed to continue, if this sixth extinction is allowed to continue, life would take millions of years to recover, and our species itself would disappear early on. So, you know, it's really raising this question of the pulling species out of existence affects whole ecosystems, and you can have like a buildup and a snowballing of collapse of ecosystems, which we're seeing many signs of already in the world today. And without functioning, diverse, healthy, vibrant ecosystems, humanity really is not long for this planet. So, you know, there's the question of both. There's the question of it's criminal that all these species that we, you know, we love and we appreciate are being wiped out, and it's also going to affect human survival as well.
Well, let me ask you this, Orpheus, because I'm still kind of a little bit stuck on this, and I wanted to figure this out. It's like, you know, I know that you wrote in your piece, you wrote about that there's been, look, since the beginning of the planet, since the beginning of life forms on the planet, that there's actually been 90% of the species that have inhabited the planet over that period of time, that massive period of time, no longer exist.
Right.
And so the question is, how much of this is actually, can you say, okay, well, isn't this sort of something that naturally will happen as opposed to it's a crisis situation?
Right. It's a little bit of a complex picture there because on the one hand, you have what scientists call the background rate of extinction. And the background rate is, this is looking back over the whole history of life on this planet. The background rate of extinction is you will expect one species out of every 10,000 to go extinct in 100 years. That's kind of the normal background rate of extinction. And then you have had natural phenomena at certain periods cause very massive extinctions. This has happened 5 times in the history of the planet. The largest extinction, I think it was 250 to 300 million years ago, the Permian extinction, wiped out almost 90%, something like 90% people estimate, of the species on the planet. And then the last mass extinction was 65 million years ago. So you are talking about millions and millions and millions of years or tens of millions of years, you'll have some natural phenomena that may cause a mass extinction. As I say, we haven't seen one for 65 million years. And this was caused by a massive asteroid strike. So you do have a background rate of kind of normal extinction. You also have certain periods where there's been a truly massive extinction that happened relatively quickly. And now we have another mass extinction event that is beginning. And this time, the difference now is that this is being caused by human activity, not by nature, not by, some have been caused by climate change in the past that was caused by massive volcanoes happening and changing the amount of radiation from the sun that's kept into the atmosphere. And then you also had this asteroid strike. And there's debate about some of these other past mass extinctions, what's caused them. But this one is very different because this one is being caused by human activity. And as I say, it's not human activity in the abstract. It's not just because human nature is to wipe out other species. That's not what my point is. My point is that it's really being driven today primarily by the whole economic system that we live under of capitalism, imperialism, and we can get, you know, a lot more into that.
Yeah, and we will in a minute. I just want to first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about his recent piece, The Sixth Extinction and the Future of Life on Planet Earth. Now, Orpheus, before we get into that whole point about the significance of this being caused by the human factor, there's something else I wanted to sort of check out and jump into a little bit, the dynamics of this whole process right now.
Yeah.
The dynamics of this mass extinction. And you spent a lot of time talking about unraveling ecosystems, which was
right.
Kind of a trippy thing to consider. Let's talk about that. What are they and how does this all play out?
You see a lot of different things happening and different ways it's coming down in different parts of the planet. I mean, one thing is that we analyze this, too, in our special issue of Revolution newspaper on the environment, which is called State of Emergency, Plunder of Our Planet, the Environmental Catastrophe, and the Real Revolutionary Solution. And people can find that online at revcom.us. But we emphasize that there are many different things that are happening to the environment that are causing destruction. There's destruction of forests and wiping out of natural habitat. There's acidification in the oceans. There's the warming of the ocean. There's climate change, which is brought on by global warming. And then there's this extinction that's happening, as well as pollution, degradation of water, air, and soil. So there's this kind of whole picture of the way that this system is causing destruction to the environment. So the way these things play out and how they affect different ecosystems, there's kind of a coherence to it. At the same time, they're affecting different ecosystems in different ways. I mean, one example you might pick is the Arctic today, where you have species that have evolved over millions and millions of years to live on the ice. You know, polar bears hunting on the ice, and seals and whales and different things that live in the Arctic waters. They're adapted to a certain kind of life, and also the indigenous people in this region for the last tens of thousands of years have also been living in connection with these species. And now you have the ice disappearing due to climate change. The ice is melting. Tremendously huge amounts of ice have melted. So this whole kind of Arctic environment, this whole Arctic ecosystem is being transformed just incredibly quickly, especially over the last 50 years even. There's been huge changes. So there's a great decline of many of these species. Polar bear is one example that people know. So you have a transformation of species up there. And there is a real interaction. There is a real interrelationship in ecosystem where now species rely on each other. You hear about monarch butterflies, for example, feeding on only a certain kind of plant, the milkweed plant. When the milkweed plant is wiped out or its habitat is destroyed and so forth, it causes huge changes in terms of the monarch butterflies. This is another thing that's been happening. So this point about a real interaction of species within ecosystems and then a kind of a connection between different ecosystems and how they affect each other is a very important point. And you can have transformations of these systems, kind of the unraveling of them, and then you can have an unraveling of a world ecosystem. We can get into that in a lot of different ways in terms of what's happening in the oceans. And
I do really want to get into that because that was the thing I was thinking about. Yeah, I know you mentioned here about it's not always a matter of a slow incremental development, but there's actually a big problem right now with the phenomenon of a series of ecosystem collapses and consequent threat to the world ecosystem. And you've pointed out that scientists are now seeing signs of this major out-of-control environmental crisis that could have really huge problems, and including the sixth extinction. Let's talk about what some of those signs are.
Yeah, I mean, some of the things I'm mentioning in terms of the Arctic is very important, right? And then if you look at the ocean ecosystems as a whole, I mean, the oceans really are the foundation of life on this planet. So plankton in the oceans produce a great percentage. I think it's something like 50% of the oxygen that we breathe comes from plankton in the oceans, right? And then on the basis of this whole plankton life and other smaller organisms, microorganisms, you have a whole kind of rich ecosystem in the oceans, including things like coral reefs, which are an area that's really a concentration of marine life, right, where you have a lot of kind of a whole interacting layer of life, and you have much of the fish species on the planet kind of living in connection with these coral reefs in different ways. And one of the things that's happening as a result of climate change and also warming of the oceans is these coral reefs are dying off. The chemistry of the ocean is being changed by taking up too much carbon dioxide, which is produced by burning fossil fuels. It's affecting at least these coral reefs. In some areas, they're dying off, they're bleaching, they become white, and then they just become devoid of life. Then another thing in the oceans that's happening is that there's just this tremendous competition for fishing, you know, and it's done in a completely unsustainable way. A lot of these huge fishing interests, and the countries that are backing them up are involved in all this too, are just scooping up huge quantities of marine life off the bottom of the, you know, and off different sections of the ocean. They have, you know, these trawler nets. Some of them are like 20 miles long, and they just scoop up everything. They're very destructive to the ocean, and they also catch huge numbers of fish. So you have fish that are being over-harvested. I think it's been estimated that something like 80% of the fish species on the planet are either kind of past the point of being sustainably harvested, so they're being over-harvested. And one of the things that's happening is you have things like, in certain places with some of these technologies that scoop up huge quantities of fish, they're scooping up huge quantities of bait fish, which have never really been used by humans before, but they're a foundation of ocean life. Many other things live on them. So they're starting to scoop up huge quantities of these bait fish, and then they're using them as for things like salmon farming, you know, where they have salmon in pens and they grind up these fish and feed them to the farm salmon. All of this is being done very unsustainably. It's not being done with any real thought or planning for the needs of the ecosystems, how to keep them healthy. And you just have a real situation where there could literally be a collapse of life in the ocean.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The other thing I was thinking about, and I had just seen this movie on Indonesia, one of the things that's happening there that I imagine is playing a big role in terms of this whole thing around the onslaught, the danger of an oncoming sixth extinction, this deforestation, which is really, I mean, I'm looking at Indonesia and it's just, they're just cutting down all these things, and then they're growing palm trees and, you know, for palm oil, they're growing all this stuff. And so they're destroying the forest and then redoing everything to get palm oil.
Right.
And, you know, and it's just devastating. And you can imagine what the impact of cutting out all of these jungles, some of the most lush jungles in the world, and things that I imagine actually in terms of the ecology, really dependent upon things like the existence of these jungle areas.
Yeah, this is a very important thing. And one of the places on the planet where some of the worst deforestation is happening actually is in Indonesia. We also did do a piece on this called The Plunder of the Rainforests of Indonesia and Malaysia. That was part of that special issue that people can find online at revcom.us. But yeah, I mean, Indonesia is just a rich, it's historically been an extremely rich ecosystem. I think it's estimated that it's so diverse that Indonesia alone contains something like 10 to 15% of the world's flowering plants, birds, and mammals, reptiles and amphibians, even though it's got a very, you know, something like a little over 1% of the world's land surface. So this is an extremely rich ecosystem in these rainforests. And as you say, they're just being wiped out. They've been cut down for timber for many years, and then they've kind of outlawed timbering, but a lot of illegal logging is still going on. And now, recently, in the last 20 years or so, they're just being wiped out for the production of this thing, palm oil, which is used in things like ice cream and margarine and, you know, beauty products and stuff like that. So what's happening is just the habitat of all of these species. I mean, you have species that only exist in some of these rainforests in Indonesia, things like orangutans, you know, which are the only living ape in Asia. You have pygmy elephants. You have, you know, specific kinds of crocodiles, a rare form of rhinoceros. You have Sumatran tigers, which there are only 400 left on the planet. This was as of a few years ago. And so these, you know, the habitat of these species is being wiped out, right? So these species are being forced into smaller and smaller plots of land. You know, they're just dying out. They can't exist as the areas that they live are being decimated, and these are just huge changes that are going on in Indonesia.
Let me say again that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about his recent piece, The Sixth Extinction and the Future of Life on Planet Earth. And you can find that at revcom.us. Now, Orpheus, we're going to be moving into a point of wrapping this up, but we have about maybe 6-7 more minutes. You know, this whole point that you made earlier on in the interview where you talked about this, the difference between this extinction and the previous ones, and a big part of that being the human factor in all this. And I wanted to talk about that because you also talk about in your article, what is really the driving force behind this happening? And there were two points there that I wanted to get into. One is exactly the one that you started to talk about. If it's not greed, human nature, or idiocy, what the hell is it? And then the second thing we can get into is what's it going to take to deal with this and how would it look different?
Right. I think this is really important. I mean, one of the points that's very, very important for people to, and I want to convey and for people to grasp is that people hear about this and they just go, my God, it's so horrible. You know, I don't want to think about it, or it's what could we possibly do? And the point of the matter is we can identify what the cause of this is, and there is an actual way out through revolution. And I want to get to that at the end. But one of the points being that, as we said, this is not caused by kind of humanity in the abstract, but it's really caused by the functioning and the laws of a capitalist system. I mean, this is a system where everything is just turned into a commodity, where everything is done for profitability. And there's this huge contradiction because everything is about competition. So everything is organized. You know, like we're talking about these fishing interests. They're highly organized to carry out production, to maximize the scooping up of fish, right? Because they're competing with these other huge fishing interests from other countries that are trying to do the same thing, right? So there's this organization in the forces of production, how that's carried out. But that contrasts with a total anarchy in terms of how all this production is actually carried out and what it actually means, because there's this competition, right? So on the one hand, they're highly organized, going on globally. On the other hand, there's no planning for any of this. It's completely irrational. It's completely unsustainable. It's not based on kind of like, what are the needs of humanity? What are the needs of ecosystems? How can we harvest just this much and we'll make sure that these species are not depleted? None of it is done that way. It's just driven by these laws of competition. And also because all of these interests are private. So they're all kind of set in competition with each other. And we've got to grab this resource, turn it into production for profit before the other guy does it. And that's kind of how it functions. And one thing I really want to point out is there's an excellent article on this called On the Driving Force of Anarchy and the Dynamics of Change. Was written by Raymond Latta. That's on our website. If people go to that website, revcom.us, and they put on the Driving Force of Anarchy, they'll see this article. And it really gets deeply into this question.
Well, let's jump into the last question then, exactly this point of, so how's it going to look different? You said, okay, there's a point about making revolution. And then there's the question of, can a socialist society leading to a communist society actually make a real difference?
Right. And I think one of the things to really look at is like capitalism, as we said, it's like got this thing really embedded in its makeup about everything's for profit. Nature is just something to grab. It's a resource. It's a prize. You go out and grab it. I mean, they look at human labor this way, too. There is a real connection between how this system treats humanity and how it treats nature. And the oppression of humanity is also driven by the same system. So there's a connection there. And the solution to these things also is connected in terms of the need for a revolution. And the difference is that a revolution, a communist revolution, actual communist revolution that brings into being socialism does not have embedded in its essential makeup, you know, these laws that are driving it, laws of economics that require it to treat nature as nothing but a thing. So we're talking about not a magical solution, but if you did have a revolution, if you did have a socialist society that was moving towards communism, it wouldn't be driven by these laws to destroy nature. And in fact, there's actually thinking, and it's concentrated in the special issue I mentioned, and also in a very important piece called The Constitution for a New Socialist Republic in North America. There's really a laying out within that of how we would, on the one hand, economic development would be carried out for the needs of humanity, not for the needs of profitability and, you know, kind of enrichment of a small section of the population. But on the other hand, also, it would be a planned economy. It would be an economy that would be looking at the, you know, the limits of the natural world, and how could we have a kind of society in a world where things are done for the needs of the people, but people are brought forward as caretakers of the planet, where we're actually working on this problem, protecting and preserving natural ecosystems, where we plan out what's going to be done based on that. And that's really written into that constitution. I mean, one thing, if I have a second here, I just want to say that in this constitution, it lays out that the three criteria for social production and economic development, number one is advancing the world revolution to uproot all exploitation and oppression to emancipate humanity. Second is meeting social needs and creating a common material wealth that contributes to the all-around development of society, overcoming oppressive divisions between people, between men and women, between different nationalities. And third is protecting, preserving, and enhancing the ecosystems and the biodiversity of the planet for current and future generations. So that's written into this as a key criteria for the kind of society and the kind of revolution that this Constitution for the New Socialist Republic really is laying out. And I really want to encourage people to also go online to revcom.us to look at that, to dig into this. And, you know, people can find there really answers to these huge questions of how can we end the oppression of humanity? How can we end the devastation of nature? How can we have a society that people would really want to live in. And so if you go to that website, you can really investigate a lot of these things. You can investigate more of this movement for revolution. And you can also investigate the works and the vision of Bob Avakian, who's the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's kind of brought forward a whole new synthesis of communism, and kind of that really has an actual way out, a way to deal with these huge questions that are plaguing us, you know, that are plaguing humanity. And so I just want to, you know, really emphasize that the point isn't just doom and gloom. I mean, it is a very, very daunting picture, right, in terms of what's happening to the ecosystems. We've got to start by looking at reality and seeing how really what's happening. But on the other hand, there is a way we can move. There is a way we can deal with this. Not a magical way, not an instant thing. If you have a revolution, everything gets better. But there really is a way to work on this and protect and preserve and change the situation in terms of how we deal with the environment.
All right, Orpheus Reed, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Oh,
man.
By the way, Orpheus, one other thing. How can people get in touch with you if they want to?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks for reminding me there. Yeah, people can hit me up on Twitter. It's at Orpheus Reed. It's O-R-P-H-E-U-S-R-E-E-D. People can find me on Twitter at that place.
All right, Orpheus, thanks, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, man.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Orpheus Reed. Orpheus is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he covers environmental issues. And we've been talking with him about what scientists are calling the sixth extinction. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Alex Rogers, so stay tuned.
Can't breathe, got my hands up. 12-year-olds won't get the grow up. Can't man up, even woman up. Lost another son, bullet thought he wasn't good enough. People fed up in the crosshairs. Be aware, cause both sides scared. Beware, try keep these hands in the air. Not good when you're breathing in fear.
Welcome back. That was I Can't Breathe by Marcus Miller and featuring Chuck D. And I played that because it's a dedication to Eric Garner. Just about a year ago, on July 17th, 2014, police approached Eric Garner, a 43-year-old black man, a father of six, on a sidewalk in Staten Island, New York City. As police accused him of selling loose, untaxed cigarettes, Eric Garner told them to leave him alone. Sick and tired of constant harassment, Eric Garner declared, "It stops today." As captured on video, a plainclothes cop put him in a chokehold. The cop pushed Eric Garner's face into the ground while four officers piled on Garner, who repeated, "I can't breathe," 11 times while lying face down on the sidewalk. Eric Garner lost consciousness and lay on the sidewalk for 7 minutes while the police poked at him and joked around. He was pronounced dead at the hospital approximately 1 hour later. The New York City Medical Examiner's Office ruled Garner's death a homicide, but the Staten Island District Attorney led a grand jury to exonerate the murderers. At this point, I want to move right into the interview I did with Professor Alex Rogers a little bit more than a year ago. And again, Alex Rogers is from Oxford University, and he's the co-founder and scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean. So without any further ado, check this out. Just a little while ago, in early October, the International Program on the State of the Ocean developed a whole new study on what the hell is happening with the oceans. And if you remember, this is a group that we talked to a little while ago, and we talked with them about what's going on with the oceans, and the report indicated that there was some very, very heavy stuff, that the oceans were in dire straits, and in fact, that the entire planet and the fate of humanity was at stake there. And this report that they just came out with says straight up, things are a hell of a lot worse than we thought, folks. They're very, very bad, and we've got to do something about it. And joining us to talk about all that is our guest, Professor Alex Rogers. Alex Rogers is a professor at Somerville College and Oxford and the scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Oceans. And he is one of the co-authors of this brand new study. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Sure. Good to talk with you again, man, even especially as we're facing these circumstances that we're in. Tell me this, man, because I want to get as much time with you as possible today. Tell me this. Just a couple weeks ago, the beginning of October, you were part of an international panel of marine scientists that demanded urgent remedies to halt ocean degradation based on findings that things are worse than you initially reported in the 2011 report. How bad is it, and what's changed since the first report?
Well, what's changed changed is that in the 2011 report, we obviously looked at multiple stressors on the oceans. And the thing that's changed now is that even in that short period of time, which is, I guess, two and a half years, more science has been done. So this has allowed us to really look at some of these stresses in more detail and also to confirm some of the things that we reported in 2011, some of which were probably a little controversial amongst the scientific community and maybe wider public at the time. But since then, we've seen scientific information come out from work that's been in progress that's really reinforced some of those messages that we reported on in 2011.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get into the particulars of this, but I wanted to also find out, just as to sort of frame this, how bad is it, man?
It's extremely bad. I mean, the one of the main findings that has really come out in scientific literature over the past 2 years has been that scientists have been able to look back through geological time and compare what's happening now to what's happened in the past when we've seen significant extinction events. And disturbingly, what's been found is that many of the symptoms of what we're seeing in present-day climate change were there in past periods of mass extinction associated with disturbances in the carbon cycle.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back to extinctions because that's a particular question. Well, maybe we can jump into this now. When you say extinctions, that the signs that were there, that are here now, were there present during many of the past extinctions. You also made in this report, it also made a comparison between now and other periods of mass extinction and said that the next one may have already begun.
That's right. I mean, when people think of a mass extinction in the past, they think all of a sudden, you know, a whole fauna changes almost overnight. But actually, historic mass extinctions take place over quite a long period of time, certainly hundreds of thousands of years, maybe even millions, possible exceptions being the end of the Cretaceous, when, of course, the Earth was hit by a large meteorite. But one of the things that's really coming through from the research at the moment is how unique the current event is. And it's unique because of the extremely high rate of carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere. And, of course, that means it's being absorbed by the oceans at a very high rate as well.
Now, just so people are clear, when you talk about mass extinctions, what are we talking about here? What exactly is a mass extinction?
Well, this is a period of time over which the extinction rate goes above normal background levels of extinction. Because, of course, at any particular period of time, there will be a certain number of species going extinct, as well as new species appearing by speciation. So an extinction, a mass extinction event, is when we see a large number of extinctions take place, which is way above the background level and generally of such a scale that we can detect that in the fossil record.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things, you know, are there certain things that you would actually say, like, you could look at this and say, look, there are signs that this is happening. You know, it seems to me these are like major, just so people are clear, when you're talking about mass extinctions, you're actually talking about a major shift in the whole way life exists on the planet, right?
Well, we're already seeing some very dramatic shifts in marine life. So as the oceans have absorbed something like 90% of the extra heat that's been generated in the atmosphere as a result of greenhouse gas emissions. And so already we're seeing dramatic shifts in the distribution of species towards the poles. We've also seen these mass die-off events of corals, these mass bleaching events as a result of increased temperature. And of course, this is happening against the background of over-exploitation of many marine resources through overfishing. So although we're seeing symptoms which have been seen in the past associated with disturbances to the carbon cycle, we've also nowadays got other stressors which are already there and already acting on marine ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into the content, the meat of this thing, because one of the things that you in the piece that you wrote in as part of the study, and also in the overall report on the study, the things that they talk about that are spoken about in terms of the major things that are changing. One of the most important things, it seemed to me in reading this, is that what's called the deadly trio and the deoxygenation, the acidification, and the warming in the oceans. Let's talk about them both individually, explain to people what those things are, but then also what happens when these three things are working together.
Yeah, I mean, obviously warming is temperature rise. So in some parts of the ocean, we've seen increases in temperature of more than 1 degree C. This might not sound that significant to your listeners, but biologically, that's highly significant, and that's what's leading to these shifts in distribution. Also, we're seeing this phenomenon of deoxygenation, where oxygen levels are being reduced in the oceans. And this is happening through several routes. One of those routes is through agricultural runoff into the coastal zone, creating these so-called dead zones. And we've seen a proliferation of those probably over the last 40 or 50 years, as we've seen industrial fertilizers being increasingly used in agriculture. Also, the heating effect on the ocean reduces the vertical mixing of the oceans, and, of course, warm water can carry less oxygen than cold water. And what this is causing out in the oceans is an expansion in depth terms of what's called the oxygen minimum zone. And this is a zone of the water column that naturally has lower oxygen than surface waters. And it's been shown that already this is compressing the habitat of fast-swimming ocean predators like marlins, which need very high oxygen, need a high oxygen content in the water. Acidification has been nicknamed global warming's evil twin. And I think the reason for that is that it sort of crept up on us almost unawares, and it actually has caught the scientific community out as well as the public. And this is caused by carbon dioxide being absorbed into seawater. This is converted to carbonic acid, and this reduces how alkaline seawater is, or makes it more acid. And this has all sorts of biological consequences, one of which is to reduce the amount of calcium carbonate dissolved in seawater. And, of course, many marine animals use that to build shells or skeletons.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to Today We're Talking with Alex Rogers. And Alex is a professor of conservation biology at the Department of Zoology at the University of Oxford and a fellow of Somerville College. He's a marine biologist with special expertise on deep sea ecosystems, and he is one of the authors. He's the scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean, and he's one of the authors of IPSO. Put out is one of the publishers, one of the co-publishers of this new report on the state of the ocean. And it's extremely, I'll tell you, you can't look at this, you can't read this without being extremely disturbed and just angry as hell. And Alex, I want to ask you then again, you have these things, you have this deadly trio, rather than, and I was really kind of amazed and stunned by the way when I dug into the report and the fact that these three things individually are problematic on their own. At the same time, you're talking about we have a situation where they work in synergy with one another, and it seems it compounds the effect of all of them, any one of them individually, right?
That's absolutely right. So, for example, studies have been done around natural carbon dioxide events. These are places which are volcanically active where carbon dioxide bubbles out the seabed. And in these places, it's been shown that there's an interaction between the acidification effect of the CO2 bubbling through the seawater, but also temperature. So at high temperatures, organisms, animals, are more seriously affected by the acidification than they are in cooler water. So there's a direct interaction between those two particular elements in the deadly trio. But if you think about the physiology of any animal, you will know that obviously we breathe in oxygen. If we get hot, our metabolic rate increases, so we demand even more oxygen. And really, it's down to the actual biology of most large organisms, most animals, that there are interactions between these phenomena, right down to the level of the way that the animal operates.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly on an environmental level, often those things work together. So warmer water, as I said, carries less oxygen. It also has the effect of raising the metabolic rate of organisms living in it. And, you know, therefore, the effect of the whole of this trio of phenomena is actually much greater than if you took any one of them singly.
Mm-hmm. Does this kind of thing also lead to algae blooms?
Algae blooms are thought to be, basically caused by a number of things. One of the things that's thought to encourage those is rising temperature. Also, where you get enrichment of coastal waters with nutrients such as nitrates, that also encourages the bloom of these things. And the other thing that happens is where you get an ecosystem that's had some of its building blocks taken out because of, for example, overfishing, then that can also encourage really almost unnatural behavior of the system. So again, it's a combination of things that can bring about favorable conditions for the proliferation of a harmful algal bloom.
Now, let me ask you this, Alex. You made a point that the ocean has actually been bearing the brunt of climate change on the Earth. And I wanted you to explain that and then go into a little bit more the question of, you know, because at the same time, you've also spoken about the ocean at some point not being able to absorb any more carbon dioxide at all, that it reaches a saturation point. And I want to talk about what causes that and what's the impact of that. So two questions there. One is, what does it mean that the ocean has been bearing the brunt of climate change? And what about this reaching a saturation point and the impact of that?
Yeah, this is something we've learned a lot more about between the first and the second IPCO reports. So in 2012, there was a very informative paper published which actually shows that the oceans, as I said earlier, have absorbed 90% of the excess heat in the atmosphere resulting from emission of greenhouse gases. So in that sense, the oceans really have taken the brunt of heat. And of course, after the last IPCC report was published a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people jumped on this fact that atmospheric temperatures appear to have been quite stable over the last 10 years. That's reflected in the surface layers of the oceans, but actually, while temperatures have been quite stable in the atmosphere and the surface layers of the oceans over this period of time, the deep ocean, the zone between 700 and 2,000 meters, has been warming up. So the oceans have actually been absorbing this excess heat, and it's thought that that is why we're not seeing such serious temperature rises in the atmosphere and surface oceans. Also, the oceans are absorbing something like a third of the CO2 that we're emitting, and in fact, are the major storage place of carbon dioxide. And that's why we've seen this acidification problem coming into being. And we're really seeing now, as I said, quite serious and, in fact, in some ways remarkable changes in marine ecosystems as a result of these climate change-driven changes in the physical environment. Now, of course, the ocean has a buffering capacity, something called alkalinity. And the reason that pH has started to drop in the oceans is because we're actually overcoming that buffering effect simply due to the rate at which we're pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And this is all about rates. You'll often hear people say, oh, yes, but of course carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have been much higher in the past. That is very true. But the thing that we've now found out is that it is likely that the rate of CO2 injection into the atmosphere has probably not been seen for at least 300 million years.
That's incredible. That was going to be my next question. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alex Rogers, who is part of the science director of the International Program for the State of the Ocean, and he's one of the co-authors of the IPSO is one of the co-authors of this new program, this new report on the State of the Ocean 2013 Perils, Prognosis, and Proposals. And it's really a harrowing and frightening and enraging report when you go all the way through it. Now, Alex, I was just going to go on to that point that you were just starting to get into, that this kind of change, the change that we're seeing in the oceans right now, is, in terms of scale and rate, is unprecedented in the known history of the Earth and is exposing organisms to intolerable and unpredictable evolutionary pressure. What are we talking about there, and what's the significance of it?
Yeah, well, if temperatures and if CO2 levels were rising slowly, then organisms naturally adapt to changes in the environment, essentially through processes of evolution. And I've done a lot of work in the Antarctic, where, of course, temperatures are much lower than elsewhere. And there, we can see clearly the signatures of how those animals have evolved. They've evolved things like antifreeze proteins, and various other ways of coping with very low temperatures and the presence of ice. But they've been able to do that because Antarctica has cooled over tens of millions of years. Now, of course, if we were talking about these types of changes over those timescales, it would not be a problem. The issue is that the CO2 levels are increasing so fast and temperatures are increasing so rapidly and that organisms don't have a chance to adapt to these changes. And that's why we're seeing, first of all, shifts in distribution, but also mortality events associated with, for example, high temperature.
All right, we have a couple more questions, Alex, and these are one's short and one's going to be relatively, I think, involved. But we have about 7 minutes to get through this, and I wanted to ask you this: are there tipping points right now when you look out at what's going on and you know how bad it is? And this whole process has been described as, I can't remember what was it called. It was called by the UN. These changes are progressive and relentless. And are there tipping points that you're really concerned about now when you look at it and say, okay, it's really bad, we're really kind of screwed here, folks, but what are tipping points that you're looking to as, like, it's just reached this terrible, even more terrible place?
Well, I think one of the really quite concerning things about this whole process is that we've already passed some tipping points. And I'll give you one example. That was in 1979 when we saw the world's first mass coral bleaching events as a result of elevated temperature. That was a tipping point for that particular ecosystem. That happened, and we didn't even realize that it had taken place until later when we saw that these events were happening with increasing frequency as a result of warming of the waters in which those corals live. I think one of the really concerning tipping points is associated with acidification. I think if emissions continue the way they are, by the end of the century, we will see serious biological impacts as a result of this acidification process. It will actually push coral reefs together with warming towards essentially elimination, as at least in terms of the way that coral ecosystems are today. It will certainly start to have major impacts on polar ecosystems because cold water absorbs more carbon dioxide and therefore polar waters becoming acidic more quickly than anywhere else. The other one is oxygen. And I think if we see a serious change in the oxygen state of the deep ocean, that's when I think things will really start to change across vast, vast areas of the ocean. And already, as I said, these oxygen minimum zones are getting broader in their vertical extent, and it's been estimated that we're already pushing something like, I think it was 800 cubic kilometers of seawater into this lower oxygen state every year as a result of this expansion of OMZ. And I can't recollect whether that is the actual figure, but I think it was something like that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the tipping points in terms of the goods and services the ocean provides for us. And in particular, the one that we need to be very worried about is its ability to absorb carbon dioxide. And certainly some of the effects on the ocean may feed back to its ability to actually take up carbon dioxide. And that's when things get really problematic because, of course, at that point, we would see accelerated rates of accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Now, the last question, Alex, you've described, or your report has described the situation as having huge implications for humans and the most important challenge faced since hominids evolved. Now, if there were absolutely no conditioning factors, somebody just came to you and said, Alex Rogers, you and the IPSO, if you could do whatever you needed to do to turn this, to reverse this whole scene, restore the oceans, restore the health of the planet, what would you do?
The very first step would be a dramatic reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. Without that, basically, we're heading towards a very, very serious change of the Earth system. So that has to be step one. And that means that states have to get together and get over their disagreements over who's to blame and who's going to, you know, actually take the brunt of the cuts. We're all in this together. And I don't think we understate the seriousness of this situation. It should be being treated as a global emergency. And really, it needs almost a Marshall Plan to actually deal with the situation.
All right, Alex, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And probably we're going to have you back as soon as these things develop, which seems to be at a breakneck pace. So Look forward to talking to you again, man.
Yeah, thanks very much, Michael. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care now. Bye.
Cheers.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Alex Rogers, a professor of conservation biology at the Department of Zoology, University of Oxford, and a fellow of Somerville College. He's also a marine biologist with special expertise on the deep sea ecosystems, and he is scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean. And they analyze current impacts on marine ecosystems globally, and they just were one of two groups that had put out a report on the State of the Ocean 2013, and it's a really frightening and enraging report. You want to get a copy of it, you need to dig this up and find it and read it and think about what you're doing. All right, you've been listening to an interview I did with Professor Alex Rogers a little bit more than a year ago. And Alex is from Oxford University. He's the co-founder and scientific director of the International Program on the State of the Ocean. And we've been talking about, all together in this show today, we've been talking about the fate of the planet. And that's something for each and every one of us to grapple with very seriously and think about how much we're going to tolerate on this front and what are we going to do to stop it, all right? So that's what you got to think about. Before we move on, I want to let people have a chance to hear something from Bob Avakian. This is a little piece Avakian did called Not Fit Caretakers for the Planet. And it's from the Revolution Talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. So check this out.
Let's look a little more fully at the history of this system, its crimes all over the world, as well as within the U.S. itself. Look at what their system is doing to the Earth, how it is wrecking the environment. In places like Brazil, as well as in places in Africa and Asia, there are beautiful rainforests full of a rich diversity of species which are being torn down and destroyed by the ever-hungry engine of this system. These are not just short-term effects. This has a long-term effect on the environment, not just in those places, but all over the world. And it has an effect on the people, too. For example, in Brazil, indigenous people, whose way of life was based on living in the rainforest, wake up one day to see a bulldozer knocking down the trees 100 yards from where they've always lived. And what's the result of this? Many of them can no longer go on living the way they were before. And one of the things that happens is many of the young women go into the cities in Brazil to become prostitutes because that's the only way they can survive. And now we have people like Bush and them talking about drilling for oil in Alaska. Once again, hungry for oil without regard to the environment or the effects on the people for generations to come. At the same time, they're breaking or refusing to sign agreements on the environment, on global warming, backing out of these agreements if they made them in the first place. Once again, these are not just so-called isolated incidents they always tell us about, the few rotten apples. This is what they have done and are doing to the environment throughout the U.S. and all over the world. To take one outrageous example of this, within the memory of many people alive today, the U.S. government carried out testing of nuclear weapons, bringing contamination and poisoning of people even inside this country itself, along with the devastation and the driving out of the whole population of the Bikini Islands in the Pacific during the late 1940s and 50s. Because of this nuclear testing in their home was no longer livable for them. Now, recently I was reading an essay called Disarming Images about an exhibit of art for nuclear disarmament, which was held in the early 1980s. And I noticed that the author of this essay points out that according to the dictionary, Webster's Third International Dictionary, the name bikini, given to the bathing suit, comes from comparing, quote, the effects of a scantily clad woman to the effects of an atomic bomb, unquote. When you think about this, and you think about the horrendous death, destruction, mutilation, and suffering alive before dying that was caused by the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan, and what would result from the much more powerful nuclear weapons these monsters have today, when you think about all that, and you think about the reasons for naming the bikini after all that, and what kind of view of women this promotes, do you need any other proof of how sick this system is, and how sick is the dominant culture it produces and promotes? And speaking again of the environment, now they are not only gutting environmental protection laws and safeguards in the U.S. itself, they are insisting that governments everywhere in the world do the same. They are declaring that even limited attempts at environmental protection are an unfair obstacle to free trade. In other words, it is in the way of their endless rampage for more profit, without regard or consideration to the cost for humanity, in this generation and for generations to come. This system and those who rule over it are not capable of carrying out economic development to meet the needs of the people now, while balancing that with the needs of future generations and requirements of safeguarding the environment. They care nothing for the rich diversity of the earth and its species, for the treasures this contains, except when and where they can turn this into profit for themselves. As our party's draft program makes clear, these people are not fit to be the caretakers of the earth.
Okay, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with his piece called Not Fit Caretakers for the Earth. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song called 1968 from The Last Internationale. I keep trying to play the song because I want people to get a chance to hear it. Extremely important. So here it is, 1968.